Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
We lost our humanity. We lost our dignity. We got punished for something we did not do.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
Our young lives were flipped upside down.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 21st of February, these are our main stories. After last week's Israeli siege and assault on a hospital in southern Gaza, UN teams have been evacuating some of the patients still there.
This is the former emergency department of National Medical Complex. And it's a death zone.
My words are not enough to express the respect what I'm feeling, not only for you, but for these people that have worked here.
Following days of negotiations, two major political parties in Pakistan say they've agreed to form a coalition government, keeping the party of Imran Khan out of power. The WHO says it's extremely concerned about the huge rise in measles infections around the world. Also in this podcast, we'll hear from this BBC reporter in his running shoes.
I'm already exhausted, and as a man, I'm only getting half the benefit.
We find out why he's having to go the extra mile. Hospitals are normally places of safety, but the World Health Organization rescue mission into Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza was to remove patients from danger. It's almost certainly saved lives. The hospital in Khan Yunis was besieged and raided by the Israeli army last week. It's seen as a Hamas outpost by the government in Jerusalem. There's no electricity, so no working ventilators for patients there. And WHO medics had to use flashlights to lead more than 30 severely ill patients out of the hospital. Paul Adams sent this report.
Yes, good luck. We're just going to pull up on the side here and then line up facing the city so they can see us over.
After 2 days of waiting, a UN convoy finally makes it to Nasser Hospital. The sounds of war nearby. This is not a simple operation. It needs coordination with the Israeli military. But there are patients inside who badly need help.
Can we get a head count for how many more spaces we have?
We still have one patient on a wheelchair, one patient on a stretcher can be fit in the ambulance.
Inside, the hospital is dark and eerie. With head torches, the team moves along filthy, deserted corridors. A handful of local staff remains, looking after around 150 patients. Anxious to get those in need of treatment out of this dismal place. Dr. Athanasios Gargavanis is part of the WHO team.
This is the former emergency department of National Medical Complex. And it's a death zone.
I will prepare the patient intubated.
Exactly.
Get me ready. I want a portable cylinder, small.
Okay. I need one arm here. One, two, three.
NASA's director, Dr. Atef Al-Hout, is here, looking shattered. He's endured long days of military siege and occupation, the presence of Israeli troops inside the complex since last Thursday, the arrest of staff members suspected of working for Hamas, the herding of patients and staff into confined areas. Dr. Gargavanis pauses to recognise what the director and his staff have been through.
My words are not enough to express the respect what I'm feeling, not only for you, but for these people that have worked here.
Huh? How many more ICU we have here?
Like a patient on life support, the hospital is barely holding on. What little power there is being used to keep a handful of ventilators running. Most departments are now empty.
This place used to reconstruct limbs of patients that otherwise would be amputated. Now this place is no longer operational.
With the sickest patients now safely aboard a fleet of ambulances and with Israeli drones flying overhead, the international team leaves Nasser Hospital behind. It's dark now and the road is full of rubble. At a field hospital in Rafah, an elderly man is helped from an ambulance. He looks blank, hardly aware of his surroundings. He's safe now, But for how long? Another patient needs dialysis. She hasn't been treated for a week. Without Nasser Hospital, healthcare in the southern Gaza Strip is deprived of one of its most important facilities. Dr. Rick Peepercorn is WHO's representative for Gaza and the West Bank.
We were shocked what we actually saw in Nasser Medical Complex. There's waste everywhere. Electricity was not working. Parts of the hospital are damaged and some severely damaged. We should immediately start rebuilding and making sure that Nasser Medical Complex remains and becomes functional again.
In the absence of a ceasefire, that's unlikely to happen soon. Khan Yunis is still a war zone and Rafah is next.
Paul Adams reporting from Jerusalem. With the situation in Gaza deteriorating even further, another draft resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire was presented to the UN Security Council in New York. The text had been drafted by Algeria and 13 of the 15 members of the council voted in favour. Algeria's representative Amar Benjema defended the resolution.
This resolution is a stance for truth and humanity, standing against the advocates for murder and hatred to life. Voting against it implies an endorsement of the brutal violence and collective punishment inflicted upon them.
In the voting process, Britain abstained. Once again, it was vetoed by the US. Washington's ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said the US couldn't support a resolution that would have put sensitive negotiations in jeopardy. Speaking after the session to reporters, she explained the US position.
They also called for an immediate ceasefire, which would give Hamas the cover of not releasing the hostage. Part of the ceasefire that we're working on requires that they do exactly that, and this resolution did not make that connection. And it was our concern that it would send the wrong message to Hamas.
I spoke to our correspondent at the UN, Neda Torfik, more about those American fears.
It's part of, alongside Egypt, Qatar and Israel, to get a temporary six-week pause and get a release of all hostages, and instead said that what they supported was what President Biden has called for, temporary ceasefire as soon as practicable. But what we heard from several members was a rejection of that. The Arab Group of Nations said they actually thought a Security Council would be helpful for those negotiations. China, for example, said that the U.S. position was untenable given the situation on the ground and that the continued passive avoidance of an immediate ceasefire was giving a green light to the continued slaughter of Palestinian civilians and also creating the destabilization of the entire Middle East. So a position there from the United States that wasn't really, you know, something that the rest of the council members agreed with.
And Neda, we've been hearing about a U.S. resolution which may be put forward. What will that say?
That's exactly right. The U.S. proposal, which hasn't been formally circulated to other members yet, it'll be discussed this week. But what it proposes is a temporary ceasefire as soon as practicable. Again, that is in line with what the U.S. has said publicly, but it is the strongest language they've used yet, especially in a Security Council proposal like this. So Israel, its ally, will certainly be taking note of the U.S.'s proposal. And it also focuses on Rafah. And Rafah, as we heard there from Paul, it's where everybody is looking to next. A lot of members of the Security Council today warned about the looming catastrophe there. And the U.S. proposal makes clear that it is against a military incursion into Rafah, saying that that would harm more civilians, potentially displace them into neighboring countries such as Egypt, and that it would impact international peace and security. But again, given the divisions on the council that we see, you know, Russia, for example, accused the United States of putting that proposal out there just to distract from its veto, its third veto so far. And others said they just hadn't had a chance to look at it yet to give their feedback on the U.S.'s position.
Given what you know about the positions of many countries there at the U.N., Would it be likely to pass?
Well, look, I think whether it gets kind of the necessary votes to pass from other members, it's unclear at the moment, again, because they haven't started negotiations. But I think we could certainly see it being vetoed, even if it does get enough support from other members by the likes of China and Russia. They have vetoed past U.S. resolutions because it didn't call for an immediate ceasefire. And they believe at this point, you know, just given the large scale of the death of Palestinians, where nearly 30,000 Palestinians who have been killed by Israel's military operation, they feel a ceasefire is necessary for that and to get the hostages released. So I think we could very much see them veto a call like this from the U.S.
Neda Torfik at the UN in New York. Israel is to cap the number of Muslim citizens who can attend prayers at Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque during the Ramadan holy month. Despite fears, this could inflame religious tensions. Here's Mike Thompson.
It's thought the move, designed to prevent flare-ups at this extremely tense time, could land up doing the very opposite. More than 100,000 Muslims would normally pack into the Al-Aqsa Mosque at peak times during Ramadan, but the new cap will at least halve those allowed in. The mosque, known as the Temple Mount to Jews, is deeply holy to both Muslims and Jews. The head of Israel's Shin Bet Security Service has opposed the measure. Ronan Bar said it could greatly inflame tensions by making Israel's war against Hamas appear to be one against Muslims in general.
Mike Thompson. It has been 11 days since controversial national elections in Pakistan produced no clear winner. Now, two major political parties say they've reached an agreement to form a coalition government. Our South Asia editor, Ambrasan Etarajan, tell me about the two parties that are coming together.
One is Pakistan Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, and then the Pakistan People's Party. Both say that they are now forming a coalition government with the help of four other regional parties. Now, why this is important? The independent candidates, backed by the jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan, they won the highest number of seats, but not enough for a majority. And also, he fell out of favor with the country's powerful military. That means it's difficult to form a government without the blessings of the military in Pakistan. Now, the Pakistan Muslim League and the Pakistan People's Party, they emerged as number two and number three. There have been protracted negotiations over who will be the prime minister and who will be the president. Now it has emerged that Asif Ali Zardari, the father of the PPP chairman, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, will be the presidential candidate. And then the prime minister will be the brother of Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, Shahbaz Sharif. These two parties have now come together. This brings an end to the political uncertainty that was looming over Pakistan.
Ambrasan, how stable do you think this coalition will be?
Given the numbers, it looks like the coalition government could be stable. And also, the Pakistani media clearly states that this particular coalition has the blessings of the military. On the other side, the supporters of Imran Khan will say that this government lacks legitimacy because they did not win the election. We won the election. This all comes amid accusations by Mr. Khan's party. There was a massive state-orchestrated election fraud to deny them an outright victory, though the government has rejected these accusations of vote tampering. So there will always be question about how far this government is legitimate. But given Pakistan's economic crisis, given the rising cost of living and then increasing militant violence in the northwestern part of the country, the media, the civil society, they have been urging the politicians to reach an agreement to form the government. So that makes it imperative on the parties to reach a consensus rather than fighting over who will be the prime minister and president. But whether this government will be able to address these countries' economic issues, that remains to be seen.
Ambrasan Etarajan there. Now it's time to get your recipe book out, because there was a craze for home-baked sourdough bread making back during the COVID-19 pandemic. You'd hear, in many parts of the world, people talking about their precious sourdough starters. And the starter is the key ingredient, the mix of flour and water that ferments and cultivates the natural yeasts found in our environment. It makes the bread rise. You don't buy yeast. And the great thing is that once it's going, as long as you feed it, it keeps going. And you can share your starter with other bread makers. That brings us to the United States and the Oregon Trail Sourdough Preservation Society. It says it has some starter dating back to 1847, and the society likes to share it, sending out little dry samples to would-be bread makers. The only problem now, the society was mentioned on TikTok, and now it can't keep up with demand. Evan Davis spoke to Mary Buckingham, keeper of the mailbox and webmaster of the 1847 Oregon Trail Sourdough Preservation Society. So, does their sourdough starter really go back to 1847?
Yes. The guy we got it from, a man called Carl Griffiths, his great-something-grandmother, brought it across the Oregon Trail when they migrated to eastern Oregon in 1847. It could well be older than that, but he didn't have any more information than that.
Wow, so you date it back to that. Now, just talk us through what's happened, because you were sending out small dried samples of this stuff to would-be bakers who wanted to, who thought it would be nice to use.
So we've been doing this since 2000, after Carl died, and it was perfectly manageable, 2 to 3 hours a weekend, and we get, you know, 30 to 60 or so a week, sometimes more, sometimes less, and, you know, it's no big deal. And then all of a sudden, there was this TikTok, and we got inundated with 1,400 all at once, 1 week. And it's been going like that ever since.
Right. What's nice about this, though, is obviously a lot of, let's call them the TikTok generation, are suddenly being exposed to sourdough and the joys of keeping it alive, feeding it like it was a pet rabbit or something, and they're getting part of the pleasure of it.
It is a pet. There is a learning curve using it. We have lots of information on our website to help with that. And I don't know how many people are going to continue using it, because you do have to keep feeding it. But as you said at the beginning, getting a sourdough starter to be strong and stable is not that easy. There's all kinds of information that says, oh, you can just pull it out of the air and it'll be fine. A lot of them aren't. And so one that is one that's always been treasured. Ours is a very strong starter that can raise bread all by itself.
Mary Buckingham from the 1847 Oregon Trail Sourdough Preservation Society. Still to come.
What we can see is if we've got a 79% increase in cases in 2023, we would anticipate an increase in deaths in 2023 as well.
Well, the World Health Organization estimates that about 142 million children are at risk from the highly contagious measles viral infection.
When you see Iran close up, you realise just how complex a political landscape it is.
The Global Story. Smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story.
It seems that Iran's strategy at the moment is to increase the tension in the Middle East.
Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
When Israel does agree to a ceasefire in Gaza, Iran will then worry about Israel then turning its sights towards Iran again.
The Global Story. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The mother of the Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, has made a direct appeal to President Putin to release his body to her. Standing outside the Arctic prison where her son Alexei died suddenly last week, a video showed his mother, Lyudmila Navalnaya, saying the authorities were refusing to give her his remains.
За моей спиной находится колония К-3 «Полярный волк», где 16 февраля погиб мой сын.
Behind me is the IK-3 Polar Wolf colony, where my son Alexei Navalny died on February the 16th. For 5 days, I've not been able to see him. His body has not been released to me. They don't even tell me where he is. I appeal to you, Vladimir Putin. The resolution of the issue depends solely on you. Let me finally see my son.
Mr. Navalny's widow, Yulia, alleges that his body is being kept until traces of the poisonous nerve agent Novichok have disappeared. The Kremlin has denied involvement in his death. Dr. Richard Shepherd is a leading UK forensic pathologist who's conducted over 23,000 autopsies. Julian Marshall asked him for his reaction to the timescale on the release of Mr. Navalny's body to his family.
It does take time to establish these causes of death.
But they seem to have released what they believe to be the causes of death, this sudden death syndrome, very, very quickly indeed. And that can only be established once one has done not only the original examination, but also several complicated laboratory tests. So I'm confused by the conflict between it's going to take 2 weeks to establish it, and yet we know what the cause of death is.
On the face of it, medically, scientifically, there's no real reason to hang on to the body.
If they've established the cause of death as sudden death syndrome that they say, and such a thing does exist, and that can't be disputed, but you know, why do they need to hang on to the body longer? If they've established the cause of death, the body should be released to the family, and then other people can perhaps quite correctly examine the body and look at other features and see if they can confirm that that diagnosis is true.
What happens to the body after death, and in particular that two-week period?
It very much depends on how the body is stored. You know, careful storage of the body, there will be minimal degradation. But if it's not stored well, then there can be very significant changes that will obliterate any or many of the marks that might be present on it. On the other hand, if the authorities choose to embalm the body, to introduce fluids, introduce chemicals into the body, that could completely destroy and prevent any further useful analysis of what has gone on. So the two things seem to be conflicting. There is this, we need 2 weeks, but you can't have it, but we need to examine the body immediately, but it may be embalmed. So all of these things are working together basically to obfuscate what's going on.
This is only speculation, but if some toxic substance had been introduced into the body, would that dissipate over a period of 2 weeks?
It really depends what toxic substance it is. Here's a man who is incarcerated in a distant prison environment. The authorities can do what they like. There are so many possibilities, some of which may leave a trace, some of which would leave no trace in the body. And so there are many things that may or may not, injuries to the body, marks on the body, chemicals within the body. But the quicker an analysis can be performed, the more reliable it's going to be. And the longer the delay, the more that has happened to the body, the harder that is going to be to prove an alternative, not to disprove what is said.
The forensic pathologist, Dr. Richard Shepherd. Meanwhile, Russian police say they're looking for Alexei Navalny's brother, Oleg, who's facing fresh criminal charges. He's thought to have travelled to Cyprus in 2001, but since then his whereabouts have been unknown. Ransomware attacks can have a huge impact and cost lives and livelihoods. We're talking about computer hackers infiltrating areas like hospital systems, leading to lost records and crucial appointments cancelled, or hacks on oil pipeline systems in the US causing chaos at the pumps. Now, though, investigators involved in an international operation say they have severely disrupted the activities of a Russian-linked cybercrime gang. So what exactly was the gang doing and how were they taken down? Gordon Carrera is our security correspondent.
This is one of the most significant ransomware groups, known as Lockbit. Around about a quarter of known ransomware attacks are linked to their tools that they provide. So they're particularly significant around the world. And ransomware, where people lock someone's computer, steal the data, won't give it back until a ransom is paid, has been growing. And this group has been perhaps the most prominent group linked to a number of high-profile attacks. And so the aim of this law enforcement operation was to try and disrupt the group. And what appears to have happened is that, led by the UK, but also with America's FBI, with Europol and others, they infiltrated the systems of the group. They got inside. They stole the hackers' data. We hacked the hackers, as the head of Britain's National Crime Agency put it, found out about what they were doing, stole the tools that they use, and then now at this point have gone public to try and basically, as far as they can, stop this group operating at least in the same way as the past.
Now, they have been hacked, but presumably this group can then find ways around that. Is there going to be a long-term impact on this particular group and others?
That is an important question because in the past we've seen groups get taken down, as they put it, by the FBI, but then quite soon they come back up again. They find sometimes new names, sometimes new technical infrastructure. I think what's interesting about this case is Lockbit is effectively a one-stop shop for criminals who want to buy this ransomware. So what they do is they provide ransomware as, if you like, a service to people called affiliates who are customers. And what's happened is by going very public, law enforcement are also sending messages quite openly to those affiliates saying, we know who you are. We know where you are. We have your data as well. You're the customers of Lockbit. So I think what they're trying to do with that is to disrupt the whole business model of this criminal group, which relies on people, other criminals, trusting them and believing that their data is safe, if you like, with the criminals. And so I think the hope will be to kind of sow distrust within this ecosystem of criminal hackers and drive a wedge between them, and that that may have a longer lasting effect than simply a short-term technical disruption. Whether it works or not, we'll have to see.
Gordon Carrera. Measles infections across the globe have risen by nearly 80% since 2022. The World Health Organization estimates that about 142 million children are at risk from a highly contagious viral infection. The WHO says a major reason for the increase in cases is a fall in vaccination rates. Natasha Crowcroft is a technical advisor for the WHO.
What we can see is if we've got 79% increase in cases in 2023, we would anticipate an increase in deaths in 2023 as well. But we can't say it's going to be a 79% increase because it depends where the cases occur.
Well, in most cases, measles manifests itself as a rash which simply goes away. But in others, it can be very dangerous indeed. Julian Marshall spoke to the BBC's Imogen Folkes, who's in Geneva.
There can be very serious consequences. And I think one of the problems is, as you indicated there, that in many, certainly the wealthy parts of the world, we've forgotten how serious a disease it can be. And that's partly because of the very success of vaccination. But yes, it can cause blindness. It can cause damage to the heart and lungs. And it's particularly risky for children under the age of 5. And it is also highly, highly contagious. So if your levels of vaccination slip, which is what the WHO is concerned about, you know, you risk quite quickly getting a spike in cases. And this is what we are seeing now and why the WHO is sounding the alarm today.
And how much have those vaccination levels slipped in certain parts of the world?
What the WHO is saying is that to have a really good coverage, you need upwards of 95% vaccination levels, and it slipped down below 90, down to around 86%. And there are two reasons for this. One is in wealthy countries, particularly in Europe, in Switzerland, for example, where I am, I often hear colleagues of mine saying, well, I'm not going to get my kids vaccinated for measles. They don't need that stuff. It's not a problem. Sometimes heated words for me, who has to listen to the WHO warning about that. And the other is in poorer countries, because of COVID-19, all of their resources went into tackling that and shutting down and so on. And the routine immunization slipped back. And so we have twofold reason in both low-income countries and high-income countries for this spike in cases, to a level where the WHO is now very concerned that we could have a really high incidence rate in more than half the countries on the planet this year.
Imogen Folkes. South Africa will hold a general election on May the 29th. The announcement came on the same day the latest figures showed unemployment, already the highest in the world, had risen to over 32%. Andrew Ochieng reports.
Mr. Ramaphosa and his ruling African National Congress Party are hoping he can win a second term in office when the polls come. But analysts say this could be the toughest ever election for the ANC, with the opposition, mainly the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters, lying in wait. The reason? The ANC has had to deal with major corruption scandals touching on Mr. Ramaphosa and his predecessor, Jacob Zuma. Then there's the economy. Hours before the election date was announced, figures from the statistics office indicated unemployment had risen in the last quarter of last year to above 32%, meaning nearly 8 million of those eligible voters are jobless.
Andrew Ochieng. Now, it's often said that because of discrimination in the workplace, women have to work a lot harder to achieve the same level of success as men. Well, could the opposite be the case when it comes to exercise? A new American study has found that men need to spend twice as long exercising as women to get the same long-term health benefits, including a reduced risk of early death from heart attacks. It tracked the health of almost 40,000 adults between 1997 and 2019. So what's the reason behind these striking results? Our reporter Alfie Habershon has been trying to find out.
I've just gone for a quick 10-minute run around the office. It's good to be outside, even if it is a cold day here in London. My heart rate is up and I'm breathing deeper. But it's frustrating to think a woman could get similar benefits I'm getting by running for just 5 minutes. That's according to a new study by the Journal of American College of Cardiology. Co-author Martha Galati told me more.
Some of the physiologic differences that might be related to why women benefit more from less physical activity is, first of all, women have lower lean mass and lower muscle mass, and they also have smaller muscle fibers when compared with men. Additionally, women tend to have a higher density of blood flow or capillaries which feed the muscles.
It's even better news for women when it comes to lifting weights. The study said they only need to do this once a week to achieve the same benefit I might get from visiting the gym 3 times a week. So far, just 6% of sports science research has focused exclusively on women's bodies. And former British rower Baz Moffat says she hopes the results will motivate women to do more exercise where they can.
I don't want us to interpret this information as kind of patronising women and telling women, oh, well, if you can find the time, you don't need to do as much as men. I'd like to think that we look at this study and we say, right, women, anything is better than nothing, and you will be gaining physiologically, and you'll be gaining more, according to this study, than the men are. You know, you're getting more bang from your buck for every minute of exercise that you're doing.
It's worth noting that the results of the study were self-reported. This means it's possible that the male participants did less exercise in reality than they said they did, something we've all been guilty of. But perhaps either way, findings like these will push us all to do a little bit more.
That report was by Alfie Habershon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.